Hi, my name is Lynn McTaggart. Welcome to my podcast, Living the New Science. In these podcasts, I'm covering some extraordinary discoveries by frontier scientists and other new thought leaders, and why this changes everything we think about how our world works and also how we should live our lives. The other day, Brian and I attended a talk given by Lionel Shriver, the author of We Need to Talk About Kevin, who was promoting her new novel, Mania. The book is a portrait of a fictional dystopia where the mental parody movement, as she called it, has gripped society so that it's now become illegal to call anything or anyone stupid. The novel is meant to be a satire of modern times, and the talk centered around manias of today, as she calls them, the outsized response to COVID, the various culture wars, the extreme polarization of politics, the divisions over the Middle East. There's also race, gender identification, men versus women, you name it. We've seen mania after mania in recent times. Thousands of people breaking off with lifelong friends or family because they happen to have a different opinion about something like COVID or a different view about which president to vote for in the next election. Shriver talked about how hurt she was when one of her dearest friends cut off their friendship simply because they differed over the response to COVID. Another friend of mine says her family refused to allow her to come to any more family gatherings because she'd chosen not to get vaccinated against COVID, even though every vaccine of COVID, the manufacturers readily admit on the packaging itself, doesn't prevent transmission of the virus. One U.S. priest I know recently told me he hadn't been in touch with a church member. Why, I said, the fellow had been such an avid attendee. The priest shrugged. Yeah, he said, but he's become a Trumper. It got me thinking about the cancel culture, the current extreme level of intolerance toward any other opinion than the right one, in universities and the media, the shutting down of any deviation from what is now considered the right way to think. Where do these manias come from? How do they start? What in our human condition insists that we conform so much with each other? In the case of our manias of modern times, they start out with a reasonable problem requiring a reasonable solution. The beginning of the COVID epidemic, Harvey Weinstein and the abuse of women, the police killing of George Floyd. How do they get so out of hand? They're certainly not new. In the early evening of September 23rd, 1954, a policeman called Alex Deeprose of the Glasgow Police Department was called to a disturbance at Southern Necropolis, Glasgow's 100-year-old 21-acre cemetery, only to discover hundreds of children under 14, many as young as 4, armed with kitchen knives and an assortment of sharpened sticks, combing the 250,000 grave cemetery, fueled with purpose. They were there, they told the constable, to hunt down a vampire who'd kidnapped and eaten two of the local boys. Many of their parents had not only sanctioned the vigilantes, but were also out in force themselves. No one could recall where the story came from or how it started, but within a few hours, it had blanketed 3 local primary schools. By 3 o'clock, when school let out, virtually the entire student population of the Gorbals and Hutchinson Town areas of the city had bolted toward the giant Gothic arched entrance of the necropolis. For several hours, the children had crept along together under crumbling headstones, taking note of the sinister figures, backlit by the smoke and red light
that flared from the steelworks adjacent to the graveyard. Edward Cusick, headmaster of St. Bonaventure's primary school, came forward that evening to assure the anxious parents that there were no records of any missing children in Glasgow at the time. Nevertheless, night after night, the vigilantes returned after sunset to continue their search. Where did this come from? The local cinema had never shown a vampire movie. The authorities fingered the American comic book for inflaming the imaginations of Scottish youth and even passed a law prohibiting the importation of magazines or comic books portraying so-called incidents of a repulsive or horrible nature to minors, a law that remains on the books to this day. Tam Smith, who was 8 at the time, would later recall that most of the children from the cramped wards of that area of the city did not own a television set and had neither the cash nor the wherewithal to buy these exotic U.S. publications. In fact, most Glaswegian children had no idea what a vampire actually was. The Gorbals vampire incident is one of scores of examples of psychogenic illness or mass hysteria. In fact, that word happens to be recorded by Hippocrates in 400 BC to describe the inexplicable mass contagion of emotion or behavior. Mass contagion was behind the Salem witchcraft trials in 1692, when 9-year-old Betty Paris and her cousin Abigail Williams first complained of inexplicable fits, a condition that swept through the young girls of Salem, Massachusetts, resulting in the hanging and murder of 19 residents on charges of witchcraft. It was behind the rise of Nazism in the 30s. It was behind the rise of McCarthyism and anti-communism in the 50s. In his book, Talking to the Enemy, anthropologist Scott Atran argues that suicide bombers kill themselves out of a deep-seated need to be accepted by their group, not for religious reasons per se. People don't simply kill and die for a cause, writes Atran. They kill and die for each other. No matter what the incident, the symptoms of psychogenic illness are the same: a behavior or physical symptom that inexplicably spreads from person to person like a virus. Nevertheless, mass hysteria is simply an extreme version of another face of our deep urge to be the same as each other, mentally and physically. One of our most primitive urges in every social relation, whether individual or collective, is to agree with each other. No matter how obstreperous our nature, we constantly seek physical and psychic equilibrium with everyone with whom we are in contact, even if that means copying someone's desire to hunt down vampires. This need manifests in a constant and automatic impulse to synchronize physically, psychologically, and emotionally, to place ourselves in the exact same state as that of whomever we contact. Whenever we interact with another person or group of people, we display a deep and automatic impulse to connect with them, and we make constant demonstration of this impulse in our actions, emotions, behaviors, even our opinions. The most fundamental of these needs is a sense of belonging. That's where it all comes from. Humanity is profoundly tribal. We feel most at home in small clusters in which we're a part of the whole. Indeed, so primal is the need to belong that ostracism is one of the most unbearable situations human beings endure. A former Mennonite called Robert L. Baer referred to the Amish practice of shunning as a living hell of torture. This most primal of human urges not to stand apart, but simply to fit in, may well be so necessary to our existence that not satisfying it can sometimes be a matter of life or death. According to research carried out by psychologist Elaine Hatfield and Richard Rapson at the University of Hawaii, when people interact, they undergo automatic and involuntary mimicry and synchrony involving their entire bodies. When one person speaks, the listener quickly begins to adopt his facial expressions and posture. He even adopts his rate of speech, the length of his utterances, and the pauses for breath. And in fact, for the relationship to work well, Hatfield believes, even their voices must become entrained. In every social encounter, we become an expert at mimicry for a larger purpose, a seeking always within us, to bond, as I refer to it. Our need to connect with others is so all-pervasive that we readily adopt their moods, positive or negative. For instance, in one study, participants listened to a speech read by an actor, alternately using happy, unhappy, or neutral inflections of speech. When the participants later rated their own emotions, their moods identically matched those of the speaker while he was reading the speech. Furthermore, when they asked for their opinion of the speaker, those who had listened to the actor read with an unhappy voice were the least fond of him. Nicholas Christakis, a professor of sociology and medicine at Harvard University, studies how and why individual human beings cluster together, and how individuals are affected when they form these groups. Sociologists love to map these dense interrelationships and then study whether individuals get any further value from the people within their network. Scientists repeatedly witness the birds of a feather aspect of a social network. Similarity breeds connection. Christakis's first inquiry was into obesity. He had information about the body mass measurements of more than 5,000 people, and he examined whether weight gain in one person was in any way influenced by the weight gain of his friends, siblings, neighbors, or spouse. The central question he was teasing out was whether fat people seek out other fat people as friends, or whether their unhappy and unhealthy eating habits affected their friends. Christakis discovered obese people were more likely to have networks of fat friends across 3 degrees of separation, meaning the friends of their friends' friends, and vice versa. In fact, obesity was actually infectious. The likelihood of your becoming obese increased by 57% if you had a friend who became obese in any set time period. And the greatest influence was from your friends of the same sex. Furthermore, fat contagion was even stronger from a friend than from a family member or spouse. Christakis then decided to apply the same model to emotion, particularly happiness. To date, the data suggest that happiness is caused by a large group of factors, like income level, socioeconomic status, job security and fulfillment, marriages, our health, our genes, even how we feel about the current occupant in the White House, or whether we've ever won the lottery. Nevertheless, no study up until the point he did it had examined whether happiness had anything to do with the happiness of others in one's social circle. The central question in Christakis' mind was whether individuals are innately happy or unhappy and likely to be influenced by life events, for better or worse, or whether their life circumstances, largely set in motion by social context, affect their happiness levels over time. his analysis of the data showed that happiness is definitely contagious, not self-selecting. Clusters of happiness resulted from the natural spread of happiness, and not just from a happy person's tendency to find other happy people to be with. People who were surrounded by many happy people and were central in the network were more likely to become happy in the future. Happiness, like obesity, was socially contagious. Christakis and his fellow academics concluded that happiness is a collective phenomenon, and one affected largely by proximity. Those people you surround yourself with whom you have regular physical contact, in short, the friends in your psychic neighborhood, are the people who largely determine how happy you will be. Christakis went on to investigate a whole host of behaviors and found that they were all contagious. Runs on the bank caused other people to rush in to withdraw their money. Suicides among young people caused a rash of copycat activity. Cheaters on an exam begat a spate of other cheaters. We have, up until this time, viewed emotion as wholly individual, but it's now understood to be a complex interplay of influences between ourselves and all the others with whom we're in contact. Nature has designed life only in relationship, and whenever we do not recognize this, we act against our own fundamental design. The problem with all this contagion is when we start deciding that this isn't just our opinion, but the only opinion. When we start creating an in-group and an out-group. When we start ostracizing people simply because they happen to hold other opinions. When we succumb, as it's been called, to the madness of crowds. We're in the grip of a great deal of madness now. We will always be tribal. That's for sure. But ultimately, we have to acknowledge that there is a bigger tribe out there, the whole of humanity, and recognize that it is healthiest when all opinions, so long as they don't endanger lives, so long as they don't involve murder, stealing, injury, any kind of theft of someone else, have a place within it.